Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series, where today I want to share the story of a case that is just absolutely beyond belief. I had never heard of this before until I saw a tweet from somebody a few weeks ago that piqued my interest and I started researching. This is a case that is so close to being solved. There are just a couple more puzzle pieces that need to fall into place. But in fact, it's so close to being solved that many people consider that it is, but that's up for investigators to decide, I guess. There's no denying there are still so many unanswered questions surrounding this case, but I think the question of the perpetrator is about as solved as it's ever going to be, for reasons that you'll come to learn. This story is of the Bear Brook Murders, or the Allenstown Four, a case that's a result of a tangled web going back decades, a known serial killer main suspect who was identified before any of the victims, and partially solved through sheer determination and genetic genealogy. This was actually the first case in which genetic genealogy was ever used to identify a murderer, ever used in a crime. It's this case that led to the Golden State Killer being found and so many more. I really enjoy researching and getting stuck into cases where there's science involved, a sort of DNA trail to follow. If you remember my Yara Gambaresio video from years ago and found that interesting, then get yourself ready for this one, it's very similar. As I mentioned, we're still looking for some answers in this case, including the identity of one of the victims, so your attention is necessary. Our story begins on the 10th of November 1985, when two hunters, brothers, are wandering around the woods located on the Bear Brook Garden Trailer Park near Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, New Hampshire, USA. This was private property, located very near where a small camp store had once been, but had burned down just a couple of years previously. I say this to point out, this area wasn't uninhabited. It wasn't the kind of place where people would rarely venture. People definitely wandered around in these woods. Just 2 years beforehand, people would have been in this area regularly to visit this shop. Whilst wandering around the area, navigating around the debris that littered it, the brothers come across a large 55-gallon metal drum just lying on its side, and they decide to go closer to investigate. Only upon approaching the barrel, one of the brothers soon spots a human foot protruding out and something wrapped in plastic. They immediately call the police and an officer promptly turns up, wandering into the woods alone to see what the situation was. As the officer approached the barrel, it became clear that the hunter's suspicions were correct. This was a human body. The scene is secured and the immediate area is searched for any further evidence, but nothing else was found. Other deputies were called in from their homes to help, and as the call came in about a barrel in the woods, one of the wives of the officers recalled something their son had told her many months beforehand about a barrel he'd kicked over in the woods, how a milky substance came out and smelt really bad. This had to have been the same barrel, and obviously she mentioned this to her husband, and it showed that this barrel hadn't been placed there recently. This had been there months at the very least. It soon transpired that there were two bodies in this barrel, one of an adult and one child. As New Hampshire didn't have its own medical examiner's office at this time, the bodies had to be transported to Maine for examination, where it was determined that it had been an adult female aged between 23 and 33 and a young girl aged between 8 and 10. Autopsy found they both died of blunt force trauma to the head, and they died any time from 6 months to 3 years beforehand. Forensic artists at the time drew recreations of the two victims and investigators spread the word, putting up posters, speaking to locals, but nobody knew anything of a missing family. It was presumed quite early on this was a mother-daughter pair, but of course this wouldn't be proven for many years. Eventually the two bodies were released for burial and a service was presided over by both the town's Catholic priest and a Methodist minister. The victims were buried together in a steel casket so they could be easily exhumed if somebody came forward to claim their bodies, and the town came together to put a headstone in place, reading, "Here lies the mortal remains known only to God of a woman aged 23 to 33 and a girl child aged 8 to 10. Their slain bodies were found on November 10th, 1985 in Bear Brook State Park. May their souls find peace in God's loving care. Despite hundreds of leads coming in over the coming months, the case ultimately went cold and the victims sadly remained unidentified. And so we jump forward 15 years to the year 2000, when a new investigator was assigned to work the cold case. New Hampshire didn't have its own cold case unit at this time. There's a fantastic podcast about this case entitled Bear Brook that I highly recommend you listen to if you want a super deep dive, featuring interviews with many of the people closely involved in this. One of those interviews being with State Police Sergeant John Cody. In the podcast, he says that he had recently joined the Major Crimes Unit, and due to the lack of a cold case unit, when you joined Major Crimes, you were assigned a couple of cold cases to look into when you had the time. It was very informal, but you were expected to work cases if you didn't have anything else to do. As you might guess, John Cody was assigned the Bear Brook / Allenstown murder case. He didn't know anything about this case, but once he started reading the case file, he was pulled in. He goes to the evidence storage area to look at the leftover evidence, to see the barrel and the other clues that had been left around the scene. He then decides to go to the wooded area where the barrel had been found, to sort of like get a vision of the crime scene he was dealing with. He wanders through the area looking for any clues that might be missed. Nothing in particular, but just inspiration, I guess, evidence that hadn't been picked up at the time, anything that could be a clue. He wanders much wider than the original search perimeter from 15 years beforehand, and then 300 feet away from where the first barrel had been found, he spots another. This second barrel was exactly the same as the one he'd been looking at in the evidence locker, and it piqued his interest. He looked into the barrel, which was lying on its side, and all he sees is plastic. Further investigation would reveal two more bodies. From the get-go, it was presumed that these two bodies were linked to the two that had been found 15 years earlier, and they had been there that whole time. As you can imagine, the police department got a lot of flack for this, for the fact they weren't found the first time round, and there's not really any excuses. They simply just didn't look that far in the dense wooded area. Should they have done? Probably, but as the Bear Brook podcast points out, 300 foot on a flat plain doesn't seem very far. 300 feet in a dense woodland is further than the standard person would think to look. I mean, this was remote enough that in 15 years this second barrel hadn't been discovered by anyone. In the second barrel, the bodies were found of two young girls, one aged between 2 and 4 years old and the other between 1 and 3. And due to the years that had passed, they were too decomposed for a cause of death to be determined, but the medical examiner did rule it was murder. He said, "This case was particularly heinous and brutal. It either shows some kind of relationship between the perpetrator and victims that's so close and personal where they were bludgeoned and put in barrels, but people who murder their entire families more often use methods like poisoning or shooting. Crimes of intense violence are typically committed against a single victim. On the other hand, a serial perpetrator, a serial stalker with multiple victims, as we believe they're from one time, that gives a different profile, a psychotic profile." At the time, it wasn't even conclusive that the two bodies found in the second barrel were definitely female, with forensic investigator Kim Fallon stating that you can't get sex from skeletal morphology when they're that young. They have things that suggest they're female, but it's not definite. It was later confirmed, though, that they were both indeed female. By this point in time, DNA technology had come far enough that it was finally able to be used, and analysis quickly determined a maternal relationship between three of the victims, the woman and the oldest and youngest children. It could only show that they were related through the maternal line though, so they could have been mother-daughter, sisters, or even like aunt and nieces. But from what I can gather, they worked under the assumption that it was a mother and daughters from early on. Very strangely though, the middle-aged child was of no relation to the older woman, nor to the other two children. What was her connection, and why had she ended up in the same situation as the rest? The discovery of two more victims in this case didn't lead to any more answers, just adding more murkiness to the story. How can what seemed to be a whole family go missing and nobody be out there looking for them? Canvassing of the local area only provided one answer. They definitely weren't from Allenstown. In 2009, the case finally got handed over to New Hampshire's brand new cold case unit, but still no answers could be found. In 2012, the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children joined the case, and a couple of years after that, they released more detailed facial reconstructions of all four victims in the hope that someone somewhere would recognise one or all of the faces. About the same time as releasing this information at a press conference, it was also announced that radioisotope testing had been conducted on the victims' remains. Isotope testing is something I've spoken about in quite a few videos in the past, but for anyone new here, isotopes found in the human body, so like bones, hair, teeth, can provide something of a map of a person's life. Taken from an essay on the National Institute of Justice's website, for forensic purposes, isotope ratios of different elements like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen will vary based on a person's exposure to environmental factors such as drinking water and nutrients in food. Therefore, isotope ratios can be used as a molecular signature to reflect an individual's habits and daily exposure to the environment. So the water you drink, the air you breathe, the food you eat differs depending on where you are in the world. Hair is one of the easiest things to test for isotopes as it grows so slowly. If you move around a lot, depending on how long your hair is, the bottom of your hair might show where you lived 2-3 years ago, whilst the fresh growth at the crown of your head will show where you've been more recently. Obviously, all depending on how long your hair is. Teeth will show even further back into your past as they grow in childhood and hopefully stick around for the rest of your adult life. I'm very much summarising a very complicated topic for the sake of understanding here, but that's the basic idea. Your body is like a map of your past. Isotope testing is a lengthy process and usually doesn't provide many solid answers, so it's often used as a last resort in cold cases such as this one. But it did provide some clues in the Bearbrook case that would prove to be vital. Pulling again this information from the incredible Bearbrook podcast, the main isotope clue came from leaded gasoline. So from like the 1920s all the way through to the 1970s, cars all over the world would use leaded gasoline, which you'll basically find traces of in soil all over the world. The gasoline was different though, depending on where you were in the world. For example, in the USA, the lead came from a mine in Mississippi, and in Europe, it came from a mine in Australia, so it was very easy to tell apart. It was through this that confirmation came that these victims were definitely from North America, which isn't particularly shocking or helpful, but it was something. It narrowed down the search the smallest bit. But then further testing showed that the mother and two daughters had definitely been living together since the child's births. The third child had come from somewhere else. The mother and biological daughters had been living in or raised in either New England, sort of down to West Virginia, the upper Midwest, or the West Coast, so Oregon, California. The unrelated child was from upstate New York or northern Maine or different parts of the Midwest and the West Coast. Definitely not from around Bearbrook State Park though. So that was where they'd all sort of grown up, but testing on their hair could provide further answers about their more recent history. Testing on the adult victim showed that in the few months before her death, she had been living in the Bearbrook area, but about 5 to 7 months before her death, she travelled to either the north or the west, somewhere where it was colder. The third unrelated child's isotopes also showed the same change, suggesting that this could have been when she joined the family. All four victims were definitely together in New England in the last 2 weeks to 3 months before their deaths. Why did this child join the family? Was she adopted? Was she kidnapped? Was there someone else involved? Again, these answers just provided more questions. How can a whole family go missing as well as another child and no one noticed? It was possible, of course, that somebody had reported the four as missing, but the report didn't get picked up nationally, with a National Missing Persons Database created long after the murders took place. After all of this information was announced, the case goes quiet once again. It doesn't lead to any big movements in it. It remains cold. But in order to provide you with answers here and begin to tie things together, we need to completely switch stories and travel back to 2002 in California, where a 45-year-old woman called Onsoon June is reported as missing by concerned friends. Onsoon was a smart woman. She was a chemist for a biotech company, but she was also incredibly creative and used pottery as her artistic outlet. Many of her friends and family still have vases and pots that she made for them over the years. Onsoon was also incredibly trusting, always seeing the best in people, a trait that would tragically prove to be her downfall when she met a man called Lawrence Vanner, or Larry Vanner for short. Around 1999, Onsoon met Larry when he was working as a handyman in California. They got talking at a Korean restaurant whilst he was repairing something. Onsoon said she had some repair work that needed to be done at her home, and that was it. Soon the couple moved in together at her home in Richmond, California, and they became inseparable. But not in the cute honeymoon period way that you often see with couples, like in a worrying kind of way. Onsoon first introduced Larry to her friends and family in December 1999, and he didn't make the best impression. Something was clearly very off with him, but Onsoon didn't want to hear it. Rose-tinted glasses and probably an element of abuse keeping her quiet. In 2001, the pair get married in an unofficial ceremony. They didn't have a marriage license, so it wasn't legally binding, but for all intents and purposes, they considered themselves man and wife. Slowly, Onsoon gets isolated away from her loved ones until she stops communicating altogether, and nobody hears anything from her past June 2002. Friends would try and get in contact with her. Each time Larry answered the phone with some sort of excuse. She's gone to care for a sick mother, or she's out of town tending to a property they owned, or she was out shopping. Or she had decided that she didn't like her friends anymore and she didn't want them in her life. There was always something with Larry, but it wasn't long until her friends really started to worry that something was wrong. In the end, her friend Renee Rose went to the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department to report her as missing. The person to deal with this case was homicide detective Roxanne Grunheid, and hers is a very important name in this story. In her inquiries into Onsoon's location, Roxanne spoke to Larry Vanner, later telling ABC News' 2020, he was polite and soft-spoken and very smart, and with his twinkly blue eyes he could get somebody to maybe trust him. All we were really trying to do was determine where Onsoon was and if she was okay, and he wasn't being cooperative with that at all. When somebody's story keeps changing, it means that they either made something up, can't remember what they told you the first time, or that they're lying to you. Detectives question Larry and ask for his fingerprints, the results of which come back incredibly quickly. It turned out that Larry Vanner had lived under several different names over the years, the names Curtis Kimball and Gerald Mockerman flashing up almost immediately. It also came up that Curtis Kimball was wanted on a parole violation for the last 12 years, after he'd spent a year and a half in prison on child abandonment charges. On the day he was released, he skipped town, violating his parole, and hadn't been seen or heard from since, until now, under the alias Larry Vanner. This was enough cause to search his home. Investigators searched the house, finding nothing in the main building, but then they headed out to the outhouse or garage space, some say it's more of a shed, in which Onsoon would do her pottery. This space had a basement, and immediately when investigators walked down the stairs, they knew that something was not right. Amid the tangle of wires that snaked through the space, there was strangely an enormous pile of cat litter, 4 to 5 feet wide and 2 to 3 feet high. There was no smell, but this was undeniably strange, the feeling only compounded by an axe leaning up against the wall. Knowing that they were probably about to find something very strange, the scene was photographed, sort of cordoned off as a crime scene, before they even started to dig in this pile of cat litter, in which, sure enough, they soon come across a foot in a flip-flop, completely mummified. As you can guess, the body was that of Onsoon, who investigators determined had died from blunt force trauma. Obviously, as Onsoon had been found on her and Larry Vanner's private property, it was quite clear that the only person who could be responsible was Larry himself, but investigators needed more evidence. There could be no chance that he was going to get off of this on a technicality, so Roxanne goes out in search of more evidence that could be used against him. She focuses in on the cat litter, knowing that somebody going into a store and buying that much litter would be noticeable, somebody would remember that. She goes to a nearby pet store and asks the question, and what would you know? The cashier did remember selling an obscene amount of cat litter to a man exactly matching Larry Vanner's description. That was all they needed, and in November 2002 he was arrested and charged with murder, but under the name Curtis Kimball. Although it was probably known at this point that Curtis itself was an alias, it was the earliest identity they had on file for this mysterious man, so that's what he was arrested under. In 2003, he was sentenced to 15 years in prison for his crime after changing his plea relatively last minute to guilty. It's very rare that somebody changes from a not guilty to a guilty plea in the case of murder, but it turns out that Larry, Curtis, whatever his name was, probably realised that he didn't want to go through a whole trial where prosecutors would dig through his past with a fine-tooth comb, under whatever names they had for him. Because, as it turns out, the murder of Onsoon was only the tip of the iceberg. Once Detective Roxanne Greenhide had started to delve down the rabbit hole of Larry, Curtis, Gerald's life, she knew she had to go even further. She wanted to know who the child was that he'd abandoned, and was Onsoon really the first victim of his? According to his criminal file, the child that Curtis Kimball had abandoned back in 1986 was his 5-year-old daughter, Lisa. At this time, he was using the name Gordon Jensen and was living in an RV park in Cypress, California, where he worked as a handyman and electrician. Whilst at the RV park, Gordon Jensen and Lisa make friends with an elderly couple called Richard and Catherine Decker, who had a grandson around Lisa's age. Gordon told the Deckers that Lisa's mum had died when she was a baby, and the Deckers would care for her whilst Gordon was working, and they very quickly became concerned at how thin Lisa was. It was very clear that she wasn't being cared for properly, and Gordon would often share with them how much he was struggling with single fatherhood. So the Deckers came up with a proposition. Their adult daughter was struggling to conceive and was considering adoption. How would Gordon feel about her adopting Lisa? He very quickly agreed and offered Lisa up for a trial adoption. If all worked out, they would come back in a few weeks' time with an attorney to make the adoption legal. Only once away from Gordon, Lisa started to open up about the abuse she suffered at the hands of her father. I don't think I need to detail the type of abuse I'm alluding to here. The Deckers realised that they needed to get Lisa adopted as soon as possible so she could never go back to this man before Gordon changed his mind. Only when they returned to the RV park, he had disappeared and they had to turn to the police, who took Lisa into protective custody. The Deckers legally couldn't keep Lisa, although they wanted to, and they had likely saved her life. Lisa ended up going to foster care and she was eventually adopted. As all this is going on, a warrant goes out for Gordon's arrest under a child abandonment charge. Investigators quickly realised that Gordon Jensen was a fake name, but they were able to pull one of his fingerprints from the RV park, and that's when his name came back as Curtis Kimball, who already had an arrest record after being pulled over for drunk driving, but that was it. Even his social security number was fake though, and authorities had no way to find him again, so it was just a case of waiting. 2 years later, in 1988, Curtis Kimball was arrested once again, pulled over for driving a stolen car just 3 hours south of the RV park. At this point, he gives authorities another fake name, which is where Gerald Mockman comes into the story. It's at this point that he finally gets sent to prison on the child abandonment charge, and then he gets released and disappears, not reappearing until his arrest as Larry Vanner for the murder of Onsoon. Are you keeping up? So back in 2003, with Larry Vanner, Curtis Kimball, whoever he was, now in jail for the murder of Onsoon, Detective Roxanne Greenhide still had some unanswered questions, the biggest one of which was whether Lisa was really his child in the first place, and if Lisa was even this child's real name. If he changed his name so often, what's to say he didn't change the girl's? According to the Bear Brook podcast, the process of a paternity test was started at the time of the original child abandonment charge, but for some reason down the line it was never completed, perhaps because he ended up taking a plea deal. Roxanne didn't see any harm in finishing what had already been started, with samples that were already on file. And would you guess, the results came back that Curtis Kimball was not Lisa's biological father. When questioned about it in prison, Kimball denied remembering ever having a daughter, saying he was an alcoholic and his memory was awful. It was all just a game to him. Imagine poor Lisa, now an adult at 22 years old, getting the call to say her entire identity was wrong. She had no idea who she was. She was a living Jane Doe. She was so young when all of this happened that her memory wasn't much use to investigators either. Was her mother another victim of Curtis Kimball? But all lines of inquiry went nowhere. It wasn't until 10 years later that there was movement in her case, when a new detective called Peter Headley took over. He started by ruling out any toddlers or babies who'd been reported as missing around the time Lisa was a baby, and then decided to focus on finding her mother. There was evidence that over time Curtis/Gordon had told people her name was Donna or Denise, but again, more dead ends. But this was all happening at a time when at-home ancestry tests were becoming more and more popular. Lisa suggests that she gives this a go, signing up to Ancestry.com. I've done 23andMe myself, and I've been connected to hundreds of third and fourth cousins who I would have no idea existed otherwise, the tiniest slithers of our DNA matching. Well, the same happened for Lisa. When she first did the test back in, I think, 2014, the databases were tiny, but they've become more popular as time has gone on, and she's got more and more matches as more people have done it. Detective Headley then also reached out to DNA Adoption, a website that helps adoptees identify birth families through their DNA matches, and a genetic genealogist called Dr. Barbara Ray Venter responded. She said the case piqued her interest, as with Lisa, you knew even less than you usually do. Adoptees generally tend to have at least a birth date, you know when they're born. But you had none of that with Lisa, even her age was an educated guess based on her dental development back in 1986, when she came into the authorities' care. They didn't know when she was born. Barbara started working on Lisa's case in 2015 and asked her to do a 23andMe test as well to narrow down even further where she came from, the results being the USA and Canada. She then uploaded Lisa's DNA profile to databases like FamilyTree DNA and GEDmatch. By this point, they had already managed to match with a couple of fourth and fifth cousins on Ancestry.com, so Barbara asked the cousins to also upload their DNA to the databases to widen the net. With each new DNA match that popped up, more of Lisa's biological family tree began to form. Eventually, the trail led back to just one man, called Armand Bowden in New Hampshire. Armand said to ABC News, "I was contacted one day by my nephew and he was working with the Sheriff's Department out in California. They requested for me to do a DNA test and they discovered that I was the actual grandfather." Armand's daughter, Denise Bowden, had gone missing decades before, along with his granddaughter, Denise's daughter, Dawn Bowden, Lisa's birth name. Lisa has since requested privacy, which is why I'm not including any photos or further information about her in this video, but she says that she is happy to be reunited with her family. Armand would tell investigators that the last time he saw his daughter and granddaughter was around Thanksgiving 1981, when Denise was in a relationship with a man called Bob Evans. Dawn was only 5 months old when Denise and Bob announced they were leaving town, being Manchester, New Hampshire, because they owed people a lot of money. And then they just disappeared. Armand sent investigators photos of the man he believed to be Bob Evans, who would turn out to be the same man as Curtis Kimball, Larry Vanner, Gordon Jensen, Gerald Mockman, yet another alias. With each piece of this man's life that came into focus, it only became clear that they were scratching the surface. He started to become known as the Chameleon, switching identities to slip through the cracks. And this is when things get really interesting, because it's the first connection back to New Hampshire, where the first of the Bear Brooks bodies would be found in 1985, by which point Curtis Kimball was already living in California with Lisa/Dawn Bowden. And now authorities knew that Denise Bowden had gone missing from New Hampshire not long before the Bear Brooks bodies were found, so naturally they found themselves questioning whether the adult victim in the barrels could have been her. As Carol Schweitzer, a supervisor of the Forensic Services Unit at the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children, said to ABC News, they knew that Bob Evans spent a good amount of time on the property where the barrels had been found because he used to fix up and do some electrical work at the camp store that was right there before it eventually burned down. This was a very strong connection. However, in 2017, New Hampshire police held a press conference to announce that Lisa's DNA did not match the adult victim, meaning that it couldn't have been her biological mother. By this point, Curtis Kimball, I'm just going to stick to using that name for him as that's what he was imprisoned under, had already died of a combination of lung cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and pneumonia in prison in California back in 2010. But investigators did still have access to some of his DNA. Almost on a whim, they decided to test this DNA they had of his against the four bodies found at Bear Brook, and the result shocked everyone. The middle child, the one unrelated to the other three victims, came back as the biological daughter of Curtis Kimball, or Bob Evans as he likely would have been known at this time. This was all of the evidence investigators needed to name him as their number one suspect in the murders. The chances of it not being him with this amount of evidence was incredibly slim. Of course, he was dead by this point, so there was no way of questioning him, but he was a known killer, a known child molester, with an incredibly shady past. It had to be him, and it still has to be him. And so this became an incredibly rare case where the authorities knew who the killer was, but not the identity of any of the victims. The only time that usually happens is when you're dealing with a serial killer, and that's what Curtis Kimball was. But they still knew that Curtis Kimball was not his real name, nor were any of his other aliases. Who was this name, and what more was he running from? How many more victims did he have out there? This is where Dr. Barbara Ray Venter, who helped solve the mystery of Lisa's identity, is called upon once again. She used a similar technique to before, entering Curtis's DNA into genealogy databases, striking matches with distant cousins, and slowly but surely building out a family tree. This was apparently the first time that genetic genealogy had been used to solve a case such as this one, and as we know, it's the same technique that would go on to be used to capture the Golden State Killer, and many, many more to come over the coming years, I'm sure. This was a huge turning point in criminal investigations and would change the landscape of criminal investigations forever. It will never be the same again. But Barbara worked through a family tree until she came across a family that she was sure could provide answers as to who Curtis Kimball really was, including a woman called Diane Klepfer, formerly Diane Rasmussen. One day in the summer of 2017, Diane received a call from her mother, who said that detectives from the Cold Case Unit in New Hampshire wanted to talk to her. She said to the Bearbrook podcast that she believed her mother had done something in the past that was catching up with her. It didn't occur to her it was her absent father until her mother pointed out that it probably was to do with him. Diane and her mother met with New Hampshire detectives in Illinois, where Diane lived at the time, and they shared the story of the man they referred to as Curtis Kimball. But they had reason to believe that his real identity was actually Terry Peder Rasmussen, Diane's father. They asked for a DNA sample to confirm their suspicions, to which she obliged. Diane hoped they were wrong. Although her father had abandoned her family many, many years ago, the thought of being the daughter of a man like Curtis Kimball was chilling. But they weren't wrong. Through DNA, it was confirmed that Curtis Kimball was Terry Peder Rasmussen. Finally, they had his true identity. I don't want to spend too long focusing on the life and story of Rasmussen. We've focused enough on him throughout this video, but I'll give you a brief overview. He was born in Colorado in December 1943 and enlisted in the USA Navy when he was of age, being discharged when he was 23. He married his wife, Diane's mother, in July 1968 in Hawaii, and the couple moved to Arizona the next year where they had twin daughters. The year after that, they moved to California and had a son and then another daughter. They moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and then his wife left him in 1973, taking the children with her, although the divorce wouldn't be finalised for years. He was abusive to both his wife and children. The next year, he arrives to visit his family whilst in the company of an unidentified female, saying that he was now living in Texas. That would be the last time they would ever see him. It seems he would remain in Texas, in Ingleside in Houston, before around 1978 to 1979, when he appears in New Hampshire as Bob Evans, and we know the story from there. Finding his name was the final piece of the puzzle of his life, but as we know, there were still questions surrounding the identities of his victims, including the Bearbrook victims. But there was one woman who had been paying close attention, a research librarian from Connecticut called Rebecca Heath. In her spare time, Rebecca dedicated herself to identifying these victims, poring over internet forums and every spare moment she got. She was looking for people who were looking for their loved ones, looking for information that matched what law enforcement had released about the Bearbrook victims. Multiple times she'd follow up on what she thought was a solid lead, only for it to not match, and so she'd give up and start again. Knowing that Terry Rasmussen had been named as the one and only suspect in the murders, she made connections back to him, scouring ancestry message boards of people missing from California where he'd been arrested, or people missing sisters. Rebecca made a list of names of possible identities for the Bear Brook victims, focusing on identifying the adult woman and hoping the identities of the three children would come along with that. She said, "I would just go through that list and then I would start searching to see if they had public records, if the person was alive, see if I could find any record for their existence. If not, then I would pursue it a little further and reach out to the person who had originally posted looking for the loved ones." Deep on the internet, Rebecca would find a post from 1999 in which a relative was looking for Sarah McWaters and her mother, Marlise McWaters. As she dove into this search, Rebecca came across another relative also looking for Marlise, who said that she was also the mother of a girl named Marie Vaughan. Rolling with it, Rebecca posted in a Facebook group about the Rasmussen case, about these possibly being the identities of three of the Allenstown Four, but she didn't get a response, so she dropped it. But then a year later, she was listening to the Bear Brook podcast that I've referenced multiple times throughout this video, and something mentioned by the host took her mind back to the missing Marlise and her two daughters. She decided at that point that she needed to reach out to the woman who had made the original post online back in 1999. The post luckily contained an email address which Rebecca tried to match to an active Facebook profile, and she did find a match. She messaged the woman and within minutes received a response, confirming that she had indeed found the right person. Rebecca asked her if she had any more information about Marlise and Sarah, at which point the woman said that Marlise had married a man with the last name Rasmussen shortly before she disappeared. As you can imagine, Rebecca's stomach dropped, knowing in that moment that she'd done what every web sleuth aims to do, to help provide answers in a case. As she said, "I knew right away. There's no way that woman goes missing with those children with a guy with that last name, Rasmussen. It's just way too coincidental." Rebecca didn't mention anything to the woman about her suspicions at that point, but instead started reaching out to the other person whose message she'd found, who'd mentioned Marie Vaughan. They told her that Marie's mother had left California with a man named Terry Rasmussen. Within just 2 hours, Rebecca was on the phone with law enforcement in San Bernardino, California, who turned the information over to New Hampshire. It just so happened that New Hampshire investigators were already examining DNA based on information from the family of Marie Vaughan. Through advances in DNA technology, investigators had finally been able to obtain DNA profiles from the degraded remains. And with that, we're back to genetic genealogist Dr. Barbara Ray Venter, who was now able to confirm the identities of the victims, helped by Rebecca's information and DNA technology advances. In June 2019, New Hampshire authorities led a press conference to announce they had identified three of the four Bear Brook victims. The adult victim was identified as Marlise Elizabeth Honeychurch, born in Stamford, Connecticut in 1954. She was the second oldest of five girls and her parents had separated around 1961, at which point her mum took the three younger girls to California and Marlise and her older sister stayed in Connecticut with their dad. At age 15, Marlise ended up moving to California to live with her mum, at which point she took the name Marlise Salomon. In 1970, she met and started a relationship with her boyfriend and would marry him on June 12, 1971 in Las Vegas. They would have a daughter, Marie Elizabeth Vaughan, in 1971 in Artesia, California, and a year later they moved to Connecticut, before a year after that they moved to Fall River, Massachusetts. You see how all of these states are matching up with the isotope testing. Her husband at this point was in the Navy, and in February 1974 they divorced. Just months later, in September 1974, Marlise married her second husband, just over 3 years later giving birth to her second daughter, Sarah Lynn McWaters, in December 1977 in Hawaiian Gardens, California. Marlise was 24 years old when she was last seen by her family in November 1978, at which point she'd visited them in La Puente, California for Thanksgiving Day. On the day she was last seen, she'd had an argument with her mother over a trivial matter, according to the police news release, and then they never saw her or her two daughters ever again. She turned up at Thanksgiving that day with her boyfriend, a man she introduced as Terry Rasmussen. She left the event with Terry and was never seen again, at least by anyone who knew her personally, until her and her daughter's bodies were uncovered in the barrels over the coming decades. Interestingly, the bodies were found in 1985, at which point it thought they had been in there anywhere from 6 months to 3 years. My lease left with Terry towards the end of 1978, so it's likely they lived together or were together for at least a few years before he murdered her and her children. It's thought that Malise may have taken on a pseudonym, Elizabeth Evans, and lived with Terry, who was now going under the name of Bob Evans, in Manchester, New Hampshire around 1980, but that's not confirmed as far as I can find. The name Elizabeth Evans was listed on a 1980 arrest report as the spouse of Bob Evans, and Elizabeth was Malise's middle name. If Malise was not Elizabeth, this could potentially mean there's another unfound or unidentified victim of Rasmussen somewhere out there. That's just one of the mysteries that we have yet to solve around this case. But possibly the most pressing one is finding the identity of the still unidentified middle child, Terry Rasmussen's biological daughter, unrelated to Malise. The most recent update I could find surrounding this comes from January 2021, with cold case investigators still working tirelessly to find out her identity and potentially the identity of another victim of Terry Rasmussen in the form of her unknown mother. As part of a news release towards the end of January last year, it was announced that examination of the genetic composition of the child and genealogy research suggests that the mother of this child has relatives in Pearl River County, Mississippi. Through genetic genealogy and just working back through the family tree, it has been found that the child and her mother could be the descendants of a man called Thomas Mitchell, who was born in 1836, or William Livings, who was born in 1826. She would be the 5 times or 6 times great-grandchild of one of these men. If you're interested in ancestry and know either of these names in your family tree, please contact the authorities. It's believed that the unidentified child here, the daughter of Terry Rasmussen, was between 2 and 4 years old when she was killed, meaning she was born at some point between 1976 and 1977, potentially. She would have died sometime between 1979 and 1981. The child had slightly wavy brown hair and was between 3'3" and 3'9". Bone analysis suggests that she may have had anemia in life, and DNA testing reveals that she is primarily Caucasian with a small amount of Asian, Black and Native American history. She also had a slight overbite. From what I can gather, investigators have made contact with distant cousins, I'm talking fifth cousins, very, very distant, but no one's been able to provide any helpful information. I mean, do you know any of your fifth cousins, descendants of your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents? I didn't think so. I have no doubt that eventually they will be able to narrow down the search even further and place that final puzzle piece here, but they do need assistance. Louisiana State Police investigators have reached out to the local public, asking for their help and imploring them to upload their DNA data to genealogical websites to assist in the case. So if you live around Louisiana, Mississippi, please see if there's anything you can do to help. The final mystery to solve is the location of Denise Bowden, Lisa's mother, who hasn't been seen since November 26, 1981, in Goffstown, New Hampshire. Shortly after this, she left her Manchester apartment with her boyfriend Bob Evans and her infant daughter Dawn, Lisa. She was not reported as a missing person when she left, as her family thought she'd left because of financial problems, but the circumstances surrounding her disappearance are considered suspicious. She was officially listed as a missing person in 2016, and authorities believe that Rasmussen probably killed Denise somewhere between New Hampshire and California, which is a pretty big land area to search, pretty much the whole country. Denise Bowden was a white female, aged 23 years old when she was last seen. She is between 5'4" and 5'6" and 120 to 140 pounds. She had brown hair and brown eyes and a pronounced overbite. Terry Rasmussen was a serial killer. It's known he had at least 5 victims, but chances are that number is much, much higher. Other potential victims of his are thought to be Denise and Anault, who was last seen on the 9th of June 1980, leaving a social club in Manchester, New Hampshire. She was reported as missing the next day, before being reported again in 2017, which reignited the investigation. She was 25 years old and a divorced mother of 2 sons. At the time of her disappearance, she lived on Hayward Street in Manchester, just a few doors down from where Terry Rasmussen lived as Bob Evans at the time. Naturally, connections have been made, although authorities say they don't know anything for sure. It could just be a coincidence, but they are investigating a possible connection. A small silver lining, though, is that the attention around Rasmussen has meant that Denise Deneau's case got a new lease of life and is being actively investigated. There's also 17-year-old Elizabeth Lamotte, who was missing from New Hampshire since 1984. Unknowingly, her body was found along Interstate 81 in Tennessee the next year in 1985, but they didn't know her identity for many years. Her death was ruled a homicide. She died of blunt force trauma to the head about 2 to 3 weeks before she was found. She was not officially reported as missing until 2017, after New Hampshire officials received a tip after a press conference on the Bear Brooks case, in which they were trying to find the mysterious Elizabeth Evans, who lived with Bob Evans at this time. The tip that came in suggested that Elizabeth Lamotte could be Elizabeth Evans, at which point Manchester police detectives spoke to her family, who all confirmed her disappearance. This led police to obtain DNA samples from two of her brothers, which in turn resulted in the identification of her remains in Tennessee. A sample of her remains was sent to the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification in 2006, which allowed them to develop a DNA profile, which was in turn entered into CODIS, meaning she was identified. They've now confirmed that Elizabeth Lamotte was not Elizabeth Evans, but the timing of her disappearance and death, blunt force trauma, makes them question whether she could have been a victim of Rasmussen. 14-year-old Laureen Rahn disappeared from Manchester, New Hampshire in April 1980, and she lived just a couple of blocks away from both Terry and Denise Denote. I did a video on Laureen's case many years ago, which I'll link down below if you want more information. In San Joaquin County, California, there's been an unidentified Jane Doe found in 1995 inside a refrigerator which had been dumped in a canal. Like all of Rasmussen's confirmed victims, she had died of blunt force trauma to the head, and we know Rasmussen was in California around this time. There's also a question as to whether Lisa or Dawn Bodin had any siblings. She told authorities as a child back in 1986 that she did, but they died whilst eating grass mushrooms whilst they were out camping. This has led police to believe that Rasmussen killed them too, but all of this is, of course, unconfirmed. So you probably see what I meant at the beginning of this video now. This case, the Bear Brook case, is classed by many to be solved, as it's 99.9% certain that Terry Rasmussen, a serial killer, all-round terrible human being, killed Marlies, Sarah, Marie, and his unidentified daughter. But there are still so many unanswered questions surrounding all this that I don't think it could be classed as solved at all. How can one person weave such an intricate web of lies throughout a single life? I know it all caught up with Rasmussen in the end, he got found out, but how much more is there that investigators haven't even discovered yet? I really do hope that the identity of the third little girl is just around the corner and they can find out what happened to her mother. I hope they find Denise Bodin alive and well. I hope they manage to fit more pieces into this puzzle. I'm definitely going to be paying very close attention to this story over the coming years. I can't believe I'd never heard of this case before. I read true crime all day, every day, and this case just slipped under my radar, but I'm definitely going to be paying attention to it now. Thank you so much for watching. If you do live around Louisiana or Mississippi or that general area, please do consider uploading your DNA profile to a genetic genealogy website. You could help identify this little girl. Or have a look back through your family tree, see if either of the men I mentioned are in there. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye guys.